episode 61 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Now, before starting, I want to do a quick plug for my textbook, Understanding Latin American Politics, which this podcast is named after. The book is now available in open access form. It's completely free and perfect both for the classroom and anyone interested in the topic. I'll put the link in the blurb about this episode, but you can also find it at my website, my blog, 2 weeks notice, and my Twitter feed, Greg Weeks CLT. One other cool thing is that we connected with University of North Carolina Press, the academic press, and so if you even want to order a paper copy, you can do that. That's not free, of course, but it's not too much money. Anyway, I'm currently working on the second edition of the book, which I hope to complete, fingers crossed, somewhere around the middle of 2019. Now on to today's episode, where I'm talking to Jonathan Rosen. We have a super interesting conversation about exiting gangs in El Salvador. Jonathan Rosen is assistant professor of criminal justice at Holy Family University, and he does research on drug trafficking and also gangs in Latin America, especially Central America. And notably, he's gone into prisons in El Salvador to do interviews. So Jonathan, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Thank you. So we're going to talk about an article that you just published with Jose Miguel Cruz in the journal Deviant Behavior. And I got to say, there are no political science journals with names that good. We need better names.
Indeed, indeed.
Anyway, the article is on how gang members exit their gangs. The title is Rethinking the Mechanisms of Gang Desistance in a Developing Country. And I'll put a link in the podcast intro to anybody who wants to check that out. And it's based on a survey of nearly 1,200 gang members and 24 in-depth interviews. But before we get to that, I'm going to start with the question I always ask people, and that is, how did you get interested in studying Latin America?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I started working on the issue of drug trafficking in Colombia, and I kind of fell in love with the topic of you know, security issues, particularly in Latin America. I studied in Argentina and Chile, and then I became a professor in Mexico for several years. So I maybe got into it for, you know, studying kind of the dark side, not the positive things of, you know, culture and the rich history, but kind of organized crime and the impact. Yeah. And I just fell in love with the culture and the language, and it kind of drew me to studying the issue of security in the region.
So what got you into studying the Colombian drug war, just initially, just seeing headlines or what?
Yeah, you know, I was always interested in organized crime and drug trafficking. And I was working with Bruce Bagley at the University of Miami when I was an undergraduate. And I thought, like, wow, you can actually study this stuff. Like, it's actually, you know, a legitimate, you know, thing to study. And I was just always fascinated by, you know, these kind of drug kingpins and lords and the impact they had on society in terms of violence and corruption. So I wrote my undergrad dissertation or thesis on Plan Colombia, and I kind of continued on that route since.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny how everybody has totally different stories of how they get into it. That's why I always like hearing the answer to that question.
No, definitely. Definitely.
All right. So getting back to your research, and actually first, even before that, tell me, because this always fascinates me, tell me about the experience of talking to gang members, especially in prison. What's that like?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we talked to thousands of gang members, and our sample of our survey, we had 1,200, around 1,200. But, you know, we were mainly talking to MS-13 and the 18th Street gang and various other peripheral gangs. The first couple times I was pretty nervous because, you know, these are some pretty hardened criminals. Yeah. 50% of the people we talked to were on murder charges. So I think a big part of it, and one of the criticisms that we have always is, how do you know they're telling the truth?
Sure.
And, you know, I think it can be intimidating. I actually found it, and people find this surprising, is that they were very respectful. I think being an outsider helped. They didn't look at me as much of a threat. And I said, look, we're doing a research study about reinserting gang members into society. You know, we're going to publish a report. We'll give it to the U.S. Embassy and the Salvadoran Embassy. You know, we're academics. It's anonymous. And they were really, really happy to sit and complain and tell me and Jose Miguel Cruz all the things they hated about prison and all this stuff. So if you go in first and you ask them, you know, who's your leader and tell me what to do, they'll probably, you know, won't be as kind. But I think the nature of our study was really, look, we're focused on this issue of gang desistance. How can you leave a gang, and what do gang members need to be reinserted into society? I think, though, what shocked me, and I've been to a lot of prisons around the United States and different countries, is prisons in El Salvador are just a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, they're 300% over capacity. The levels of you know, human rights obstacles in terms of overcrowding. And that just, you know, you see these photos on TV, but actually to go and see it and to be there and to, you know, smell the awful smells of, you know, 300 people in a cell that should fit, you know, 50 was definitely a crazy experience. But I found overall, and this surprises people, that they were pretty receptive and they thought it was kind of interesting because no one goes to prison to talk to gang members.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of lock them up, throw away the key and they're not a popular bunch of people. So no one comes and asks them, hey, tell me about your life.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, nobody ever says, hey, tell me what you think.
Yeah, ever. And so I think it's funny because we'd get these gang leaders who are pretty, you know, hardened criminals who'd done serious crimes and been in prison for a long time. And no one ever asked them,
yeah,
you know, tell me what would you have needed to, or what would you need, you know, if you're getting out to be a reinserted society. So I thought in that way it was kind of the hook where if you walk in and you say, hi, you know, I'm Jonathan Rosen from the United States, take me to your leader. You know, yeah. You can imagine how well that would go.
Yeah. So you note that the literature for U.S. gangs says the process of exit is highly individual, whereas in El Salvador, it's collective. So can you kind of explain the difference?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing that we found. Scott Decker and various other colleagues you know, at Arizona State University have done some amazing research on gangs in the United States. And mainly what they found is, you know, most gang members, it's kind of the age crime curve. People just age out of gangs.
Okay.
Delinquency, and most in the United States, you see this kind of unimodal curve that people stop partaking in crime when they're around 18. Now, there are some exceptions, but most people just kind of what they call knife off. They just leave. It's a sudden exit to the gang.
Yeah.
And they say, look, I'm tired. It could be marriage is a factor. They're kind of push and pull factors. Marriage, maybe a job, maybe being incarcerated deterred them, having a family, children, etc. And so people just said, look, I'm tired of this. I'm leaving the gang. Well, what we found in El Salvador is that the gangs are so powerful that for you to even really consider talking to the gang members to leave, I guess another sort of saying is you can't just leave.
Yeah.
You have to eventually basically call a meeting and you have to convince them why you are worthy of leaving. And so in some ways, you know, the only real way that they respect, and we can talk a little bit more about this, is, you know, is a religious exit. But
sure,
what I
yeah.
thought interesting was, you know, basically gangs kind of evaluate you based on how useful you are. You know, gangs want soldiers. They want foot soldiers. And when you talk to gang members, this always surprised me. They often tattoo three little dots next to their hand. And that's their outcome of what they see in life. Prison, the hospital, or death.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so they, you know, gang members don't think they're going to live long lives. You talk to kids who are, you know, 30 and that's like a, you know, a senior citizen for a gang member. So at the end of the day, I think that, you know, gang members in El Salvador have to negotiate their exits.
Okay.
And they have to convince the leaders that they really are tired of the gang and they want to leave. And now that the question was, is that how does that actually happen, right? What are the different mechanisms that you can leave a gang? Because so many people, when you talk to MS-13 members, they say, you know, you're an MS for life. The only way out is death. And what we found is, no, you actually can leave. It's definitely not easy, but it is possible.
Yeah, and so you find that a religious experience is the most likely reason for someone to leave a gang and the acceptable reason. And I found it interesting that although the gang does keep track to make sure you're really dedicated to the church, so you're not just faking it. If I read this correctly, they prohibit you from participating in gang activities once you do. So how does that whole dynamic work? Is it just the power of the Catholic Church or what?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Most of the gang members actually left through the evangelical church.
Oh, evangelical, sure. I should have thought of that.
There's some that leave through the Catholic Church, and there's some disputes about the differences. But the evangelical church has been very, very powerful you know, in the Northern Triangle countries.
Sure.
So basically what we kind of found was, you know, if there's one thing that the gang respects is kind of this higher power, and there's this process of supervision. Because we had this one question, like, are we talking to gang members to say, if they talk to me, they say they're out of the gang, then they talk to the gang, they say they're in the gang?
Yeah.
Like, what does it actually mean? And so what we found is there's this process of calming down and then kind of exiting the gang. And so what we would talk to so many people, particularly during our in-depth interviews, which we could primarily did at rehabilitation centers and churches, because it's just really honestly not as safe, you know, to do interviews on the street as it was 20 years ago. What we found is that at the end of the day, they do watch you. And so if you're committing crimes, you're drinking, you're hanging out with women, they'll, you know, warn you one time. And then the second or third time, they kill you.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting because they want you, and in some ways, and you know, I kind of have to be careful how to describe it, but in some ways, the gang is all encompassing in their lives, right? Uh-huh. But at the end of the day, when they get involved in the evangelical church, that becomes their entire life. Highly disciplined, high structured. And so if you're in that life, you have to be in that life 100% if you have this religious experience or conversion.
Yeah.
And so that's what we found is that, you know, every once in a while, if you're older and you're kind of a veteran gang member, you could say, look, you know, I'm 35. I put in all this work for the gang. I'm calming down. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, I think it's the hardest for leaders to leave because moving your way up the gang and the hierarchy, basically to even be considered to jump into a gang, you have to kill people.
Yeah.
Right. And so once you've put in a lot of work, it's assumed you're going to go to prison. No one will respect you in the gang if you don't go to prison. But once you move up in the leadership, it's really hard to give it all up, you know? And so I think being a leader is actually much harder to leave a gang than if you're an average gang member, you know, or if you're an old gang member, if you've kind of put in your time and you can just kind of shift. So that was the other thing that we found is this element of utility, where in the U.S. literature, people don't really say, like, are you a good gang member? You know, like, I'm a terrible basketball player, so they'd be happy to cut me from the team, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was interesting.
And just as an aside, kind of the origins of calm down. So is that like that's what everybody uses, like calmar or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's say that, you know, basically, you know, ya me calmé, you know, I calmed down from the gang.
Okay.
And that was a question of we were looking at as like, you know, are you calming down? Are you still in the gang?
Exactly.
Or are you out?
That's exactly right? What I was thinking.
And that was this question for us. And so at the end of the day, you don't just leave immediately. I think there is this process of calming down. So we talked to people and they'd say, look, you know, I'd stop, you know, going to the meetings. I was in this process of trying to, you know, calm down my gang activities. And then eventually you're going to have to approach the gang and say, look, you know, I want to leave because of this and that. So there's this kind of transition period where in the United States, what we found is people just left immediately. They didn't have this, you know,
parole almost
process.
It's like a supervised parole.
Right, right, right. For the rest of your life, which is kind of scary. And since El Salvador is, you know, such a small country, it can be very problematic. And particularly in terms of when you look at now you have possible enemies within your gang, but also the ex-gang members. And I think that's where tattooing becomes such a major issue, right? Because, you know, you can't even walk around the streets with, you know, a huge MS-13 tattooed on your arm because you might get killed by an 18th Street member. Just because you're calmed down doesn't mean that they still don't hate you.
Right. So do you think, are there any real options beyond the church? You note some, but is that really it?
Yeah, you know, in some ways I've been very pessimistic because I think I'm pessimistic in the strategies that the Salvadoran government has been taking. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But, you know, I think in reality, one thing that really shocked me and I made me somewhat optimistic about there is hope outside of my grand pessimism is that we went to a factory called League. And the New York Times has written about them and they have documentaries about them. But they basically make college apparel.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, a T-shirt that says UNC or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they hired ex-gang members. And they hired ex-gang members covered in tattoos. They went through this intense process of filtering. But they basically said, look, we don't discriminate. You know, we're going to give you an education. You're going to learn English. You're going to – we want you to go to college and the university. And they did all this stuff. But I think reinserting into society is so difficult. I mean, even in the United States, 6 of every 10 people that go to prison are going right back.
Yeah.
So there's this element of being a gang member – this kind of, you know, black flag or, you know, scarlet letter next to your name, you know, having possibly physical discrimination because of tattoos, etc., and then having a prison record. So in reality, I think the one challenge is like, who is going to employ these individuals?
Yeah.
And you find such high levels of discrimination, and whether the Salvadoran government likes it or not, or the population likes it or not, the majority of these kids are getting out of prison, right? Yeah. Yeah. Even if they have a 20-year sentence going in at 18, they're going to get out one day. And so the question is, what do you do? And our biggest thing is that, like, we did another article, Jose Miguel and I, based on our research with the folks at FIU, Florida International University, of in some ways it's kind of this vicious circle that if you can't find a job, you can't do anything. And honestly, many gang members don't have skills. They don't have a formal education. What they're really good at is extorting. What they're really good at is being a gang member. And so there's this kind of vortex sucking them back to the gang life if they can't find anything else.
So is immigration a solution at all? Just get out of the country?
Yeah, I mean, we would talk to many gang members who would say, look, I need to leave. Like, I'm a former gang member. I need to leave. And the question is, where do I go, right? Do I go to another country, a neighboring country where MS and the 18th Street are still powerful? And they would tell us, look, no, the United States government, we could ask for asylum, but we're going to face a lot of discrimination because of, you know, possible tattoos or gang history, et cetera.
Yep.
So some do flee. But I think, you know, that has changed in terms of the political dynamics of the difficulty of actually doing that and getting asylum. If, for example, you were going to the United States or trying to get asylum in Mexico.
Yeah. Well, asylum in the U.S. now is forget it.
Yeah. And having a gang, you know, record and having and I think the thing is that, like, a lot of these individuals that we spoke to, you know, they served their time in prison. They've committed awful, heinous crimes. But, you know, they may have done a 30-year stint in prison. And this question is, when they get out, what do they do? And so a lot of them say, look, I'm a dead man. You know, I can't walk on the streets of El Salvador. I have to leave.
Yeah.
And so the question is, well, where do you leave to? You know, in the United States, it's not, they're not going to get asylum most likely. Convention Against Torture is getting harder and harder to prove. And, you know, the government has said they're not, you know, it's the political situation has changed a lot in that. So it's kind of this question of, you know, they're kind of stuck.
Yeah. Kind of thinking methodologically, at the conclusion, you acknowledge the results could be influenced by relying on interviewees who are imprisoned. What impact do you think that might have on the results?
Yeah, so, you know, Jose Miguel, who is, you know, one of my favorite scholars, and I think, you know, has been doing this for 20, 30 years, that I don't think there's anyone better than him on this subject in terms of gangs. You know, 20 years ago, he would just do this on the streets. They'd interview people in their homes, then, you know, they could do it in different centers. Nowadays in El Salvador, given the high levels of violence, the power of the gangs, and the high levels of corruption, you can't just walk around the streets interviewing people.
Yeah.
So we got a grant doing it, and our number one through, you know, 1,000 priority was, you know, safety. And so we decided that they said, look, the prison system is the heart of the gang life. You know, you're going to go to prisons that are just dominated by gangs. And so there definitely methodologically could be a bias. We did try to, we randomly selected, and we selected among a list of gang members throughout 11, basically, prisons and jails.
Yeah.
So the jails, you get people coming right off the street. You get people who aren't yet convicted. And the prisons, we went to women's prisons. We went to different prisons that we were granted access to by the Salvadoran and U.S. government. And so in the real world, in an ideal world, we would have liked to do more interviews on the street. We basically had to do them in rehabilitation centers, and we interviewed a lot of people in League, the factory that I mentioned. But it is a limitation, and I think the one challenge is that, you know, conducting field work in El Salvador is just so difficult. And so we thought at least if we get a big enough sample, we can try to have a reflective sample of different members in the gang life. And then some people would say, well, you only interviewed people at churches for the in-depth interviews. And that's a valid thing too, right? That, like, you know, we couldn't just go randomly interview people on the streets. It just wasn't possible. And then, you know, filming something today, you know, which we weren't allowed to film anything, is just impossible. No yeah. gang member wants their face on YouTube and that type of stuff gets you killed, to be honest, if you do it.
Yeah. So it's a limitation of the data, but it's basically insurmountable, right? And there's nobody else can actually do more.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way, and I think we have the biggest sample. We were lucky, based on a grant we received, to have access. to these facilities, but I don't think there's a bigger sample, and there's just so many limitations of actually conducting it that in the real world, you know, there are many, many challenges. And so I think we did the best methodologically that we could given the limitations. We negotiate a lot which were the prisons that we went to. We actually interviewed juveniles as well. So you're talking about prisoners, which are a vulnerable population for the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, gang members who are active, and juveniles. So that's like every red flag for every university of saying, wow, this is a pretty complicated study.
Yeah, so actually in the real nuts and bolts of research, did that IRB process take you a long time?
Yeah, so we had to go through 4 full board reviews. We started doing it in phases. And basically, you know, they were really, really concerned about security as they should be, human rights, protocols, et cetera. So we really spent a lot of time saying, look, here are all the protocols that we're going through. Here's all the safety mechanisms. And that's something, you know, when we showed up in the Salvadoran prisons and said, do you want to start today? We said, no, we can't. You know, we have to go through a human subjects research committee. And they're like, excuse me? You know, it's something that's not – the IRB doesn't exist in Central America. You know, they don't have to deal with some of the stuff that U.S. institutions deal with, no matter where you are, in terms of the IRB.
Yeah. And so for listeners who aren't familiar with this, is that at universities, there's an institutional review board. So if you're going to be using human or animal subjects, if you're just going to be interviewing people, then you have to do a proposal. It has to be scrutinized. And perhaps you might have to keep revising. And the more that you're looking at talking to juveniles or talking to people who are vulnerable, people in prison, et cetera, the harder it is to get that approval. And if you don't get that approval, then you can't do the research because you're doing it as a, you know, as a person from that university. Now, thinking of the bigger picture, and this gets you sort of mentioned policy, what does this tell us, if anything, about the challenges of reducing gang numbers and violence in El Salvador? Sort of what policy lessons do you think we can take from it?
Right. No, that's a great question. I think these kind of mano dura or iron fist strategies just don't work. They're popular among the population, just rounding up gang members and youth and throwing them all in prison. But at the end of the day, it's this vicious circle. And so I think there's this challenge of, you know, you have to reform institutions. The Salvadoran government is facing major, you know, institutional crisis or institutional crises in terms of corruption. The prison systems don't rehabilitate anyone, in my, you know, humble opinion, and they're basically just schools of crime for gang members. So I think part of it is trying to figure out how do we reinsert people that are going to get out. El Salvador doesn't have the death penalty, so whether people like it or not, you know, some people get long prison sentences, but the majority are getting out. Mm-hmm. And so I think League is really a model in terms of, you know, providing kids, teaching them something, providing them an opportunity, giving them job skills, not discriminating against them. But that's really, really tough. And on the front end, I think it's, you know, there are long-term structural problems. There's so many things of why kids get involved in gangs. And I think it revolves around poverty, domestic violence, lack of education. So, you know, if you're poor in El Salvador and you grow up in a gang neighborhood, there are just major obstacles in terms of your safety. So I think on the one end is kind of what do you do with this population that already got into the gang life? And on the other end, how do you get kids to stop joining a gang? You know, the Salvadoran government has declared gang members. The Supreme Court in 2014 passed a law saying that gang members are terrorists. And it's basically so they can just put the military in the street and kind of have this war on gangs. But in reality, what you see is it just leads to more violence. And so I think it's there's no silver bullet. There's no magic solution. Every day I kind of think, you know, I think, man, like it's so easy to criticize, but it's hard to actually do something, right? And to actually implement policy requires political will. And the honest truth is that I think, you know, saying you're going to talk about reinserting gang members isn't popular among Salvadoran society. You know, Salvador is a very poor country where people say, well, I want a job and I'm not a gang member or I'm unemployed or I want a house.
And that's the same here. It's the same in the U.S.
Same in the U.S., same in the United States. And so I think, you know, whether the Salvadoran government likes it or not, it's something they have to deal with. Just like in many other countries, you know, Honduras, Guatemala, et cetera, you know, dealing with these issues. So I think what I would say is that like these iron fist strategies just lead to huge spikes in the prison population. And then you have kids who are just picked up And some, the question is, are they really gang members? You know, you do see, so, we would hear this so much, that being young and male in El Salvador is a crime. Basically, if you're young, poor, and male and live in a neighborhood, you can just get picked up nowadays for allegedly being a gang member, right? And they're charged with terrorism. So I think that's something that you think, like, you know, long-term, we have to reform many different institutions, judicial system, the prison system, and it kind of takes this whole of government approach. And just locking every young kid in prison for gang association, and there are people who have. I mean, we filtered to see who was a gang member and who wasn't. And you know, many of the people in prison deserve to be in prison because they've committed heinous crimes. But I think that's one of those things, that how do you reform multiple institutions at the same time?
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. I've been talking to Jonathan Rosen, who's assistant professor of criminal justice at Holy Family University. Jonathan, again, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.